Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Captain?
Not here.
Captain?
Report.
Signatures detected.
Shields up.
Signatures detected.
Red alert.
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair. Chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons? Klingons.
Welcome to the Greatest Discovery. It's a Star Trek Discovery podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation, which is another Star Trek podcast that we're a little bit embarrassed to have. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison.
Ben, I read that today's episode is three from the end of the second half of the first season, episode 13.
Yeah.
There's only
two more.
Yeah. And this is sort of the part of a television season when you start seeing things closed up, right?
Yeah, the characters' arcs are coming to an end, as are their lives.
We're running out of time to kill people. It's a good thing we have this Mr. Burns-like trapdoor. We can just take a piece of earth-moving equipment and just shove them in.
I had to rub my eyes and look around for a bit because I was like, are we watching an episode of Discovery or a James Bond film?
I mean, I love the reveal of the trap, the unused trapdoor, mind you.
Yeah.
Like we're not going to see that again.
Chekhov's trapdoor.
Yeah, every reveal is so pregnant on this show.
Yeah.
I think that brings up another point that we could talk about abstractly before maybe we get into the episode itself, is like, there seems to be a little bit of ham on this show. Like more ham than an increasing amount of ham, I should say, as the season goes on. Like, these are very transparent plays into the future. Like the camera is focusing on things that are used later and blown up later in a way that a lot of other shows, modern shows particularly, are a little more subtle about. And I wonder if that's like the CBS DNA, right? Like, do you feel like that's CBS lowest common denominator working here?
I don't know. I thought that I thought it was especially hammy when, I mean, spoiler alert, but someone goes through that trapdoor.
I regret nothing!
Toward the end of the episode, and then the camera cuts to Salacious Crumb laughing at him.
You see those throwing stars in the palace, and you're like, God, are we ever going to see any more of those throwing stars again? That was the only pregnancy that doesn't go full term as far as as far as what we see in this episode.
Yeah, there were some shuriken continuity issues also. Yeah. Like, there's like some times when they're there on the pedestals and other times when they're not.
Where do they go? Like, maybe you need to put them on a charging station, right?
Yeah, maybe Giorgio took them back to her quarters to plug the lightning cable into them.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, do you want to get into the episode, Adam?
Yeah, there's so much to talk about in Star Trek Discovery Season 1, Episode 13. What's past is prologue.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons? Klingons? Those are Klingons?
What the hell is going on this ship?
I haven't the slightest idea.
This episode starts in Agonizer Booth Stadium, and Lorca is taking all of his buddies off of agony support. letting them step out of the
phone booths. And
after like a year and a half, almost 2 years, what is that like?
A long time to be in agony. I suppose I can relate. and like, this is all people that have been on the Charon. And that seemed like maybe like a bit of a tactical error on the part of the Empire. Like, maybe don't keep a huge stock of people that hate you, like, on ice in the ship for somebody to thaw out later.
Yeah, I mean, keep your friends close and 200 of your enemies inside your ship, is how the saying goes, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
We get to see Landry again.
Yeah.
The Agonizer booth has done nothing to diminish her great hair and beauty, I would say.
Yeah. I would say that Landry as a character is the most similar from Prime Universe to Mirror Universe.
We still have supporters on several worlds.
She wouldn't have to try very hard to fit in on the other side, that's for sure.
Yeah. So they head up to Stamets's office, and I think we've confirmed that this is Mirror Universe Stamets, right?
Yes, I was proven wrong very early on this episode. After we were finished recording here, I will re-edit the last episode to remove
to erase the history. A lot of people were on your side, man.
If we re-edited every episode where we were wrong, all of our episodes would be 3 minutes long.
I'd say being wrong is like our main thing, Adam.
Maybe the most powerful feeling I've ever had is the idea that that so many people shared my wrong opinion at the end of the last episode.
Yeah.
We go to a little exposition university here with Mirror Universe Lorca telling us what happened.
I like the way they discover that Stamets is in the room, right? They're like looking around and all his, you know, weed cans are still here. And Lorca like detects like a little like glitch in the matrix and pulls Stamets out from behind an invisibility shield, which I guess means that Mirror Universe Imperial humans have some cloaking technology, at least on this scale.
One of the subtle things about the Mirror Universe is that they use first names when they address each other. Like,
yeah,
just a little.
They're just a little just more
a little
casual.
Bit of disrespect there.
It's like my elementary and middle school were very formal, and everybody was Mr. This and Mrs. That. And my high school, you call your teacher by the first name. It was a real casual environment.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could get used to that. That was not what it was like in my school.
It was cool. There was a real camaraderie between us and the teachers. We were all in it together. Me and Janet and Eugene. took at least 2 years to get used to. It was kind of like being in an Agonizer booth.
Right.
There is like a ton of monologuing, like an amount of villain monologuing about what happened to Lorca that I almost expected his plot to be foiled right then and there.
You're not wrong, because there are, I think, no fewer than 4 major monologues in the episode by main characters. And this is the first little bit of a flashback montage to how Lorca got there.
Now that I live in LA, I've been thinking about going out on auditions, and I've already begun preparing some of these monologues just in case, you know.
Well, they won't pick up your garbage unless you go to an audition a month. That's one of the things about living in LA.
Yeah, that's it's so fucked up how SAG controls the trash pickup.
It's like qualifying for unemployment. You got to prove that you've been to a certain number of job interviews. So I guess you don't want to transport yourself during an ion storm.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you make 2 Rikers, too, right?
Yeah.
Ion storm accident? What if transporting Lorca through the ion storm just made another Riker? Like, it was Riker-specific?
Well, I guess William and Thomas are both taken, so I'll just call myself Riker.
Frakes directed the episode a couple episodes ago, and he was like, so, like, I'm not going to be on both sides of the camera? I just sort of assumed.
I mean, I'm here, guys. I'm here.
It's quite different than what you see on television.
The thing that they get Stamets to do is trigger some kind of biological agent that kills the majority of the troops that Giorgio has stationed here on the Charon.
They don't have the kind of mixed feelings about rolling a bunch of nerve gas through the ship as they do on LV-426. Evidently, the high dollar value of the Charon is not enough of a deterrent for this plan of action.
Yeah.
Mirror Universe Burke is just like super nice, just a really nice accountant.
Yeah, yeah. He's got a full collar on his suit. It's not cut off at a weird place. This is an opportunity for Burnham to like affect an escape attempt.
This felt real GoldenEye to me, like GoldenEye in the facility.
There was a couple of times when she like hit somebody in the chest and they would get electrocuted, and I couldn't really tell what that was. Did she grab one of the shuriken or something?
Wow, I didn't think so. I just thought she found herself another power glove. This is a real power glove rich environment, I think.
You just stick your hand out and it's in one.
Yeah.
I love the power glove. It's so bad.
The baddest ass move that she pulls, though, is like she like dodges a phaser bullet and it hits a grate, and she like runs for the grate and slides through the newly open grate.
Complete with molten bars. Yeah. You know?
It is not super realistic to me that she would escape because she's like standing in the middle of a room full of people with guns. I guess maybe they're being careful about shooting at her because the Emperor is behind her. Maybe that's why she doesn't get taken out. But there's like this is a very action heavy episode, and I feel like the action directing is pretty top notch.
Now, when you're constructing a flaw grate on the Emperor's palace ship, you're going to want to use some bars that are 2 to 3 inches in diameter.
This Imperial ship used to use a weight and pulley system to raise and lower the bars, but we've gone to a modern double-pane bar system. We're just going to shim it in place and then use a 10-penny ring-shank nail to hold it while we finish the fixtures on the outside.
Ben, you're not wrong about these action scenes, and I would posit something else for you to consider. All of the action scenes in this episode feel exactly like Star Wars.
Hmm.
And there are a couple of reasons why. The bleeding brass instruments in the score, as accompanied by like the giant dark reflective spaceship, and in all of the battle scenes, there's these rows of anonymous soldiers. It feels like this is, I mean, not just a Terran Empire ship, but like a Star Wars Empire ship that they're on.
There was some sound design stuff about that too. Like, I kept hearing things that sounded like TIE fighters in this episode.
Yeah, and the director of this episode does not stop moving the camera, ever. Like, it is always floating, it is always above. Really interesting compositions. Like, the thing that does not make it like a total Star Wars cop is that the compositions are fairly different from what you get in a Star Wars movie.
It's a surprisingly heavy action episode. Like, we were talking about how, like, this is the Star Trek that's set against a war, but there have been so many episodes where it's like, you know, oh, we're jumping back in time over and over again. And like, while there's a little action in there, it's more a puzzle that they're trying to solve. And this one is about like taking people out and removing actors from the equation.
Yeah. Boy, pulse weapons sure feel like the future versus beam weapons, you know? Like all of these rifles and stuff feel like they would be from a post next gen universe.
This is definitely something that was introduced by the J.J. Abrams Kelvin universe.
Yeah.
I think that what it is we are so used to warp feeling away and phaser fire feeling away that when they added the kind of like impactful, punchy sound design to everything, it felt like really cool and new. Like, I remember really being impressed when the Enterprise first goes to warp in that first J.J. Abrams Star Trek film, and it's like, it shoots like a bullet into space. It was like a totally fresh take on that idea. And like, I'm sure that it like grated on some people as not feeling canonical, but you know, I think you have to keep up with the times.
Yeah, I mean, different doesn't mean wrong or bad or non-canonical.
The Alien universe has really struggled with this as well. Like, oh, you know, if we tell a story that happens before the events of Alien, like, do we make the ship look even shittier and more analog? Like, there's a great Alien video game on PlayStation that's like super analog feeling, and they put all these like, you know, glitched up VHS effects and stuff into the game, and all the computers look all like big and blocky and shitty the way they do in Alien.
Yeah.
And it is such a fun choice, but it, you know, it also kind of like exposes it for what it is, which is an aesthetic choice that was like originally governed by the limitations of technology and imagination at the time that the franchise was invented.
That's a great game, and it's a great example of the importance of sound design when you're creating a world, especially because I can't remember playing a game that had better sound design than that one.
Yeah, that shit is terrifying.
It's legit scary.
Yeah.
We have been waiting for someone worthy of our attention.
What? Who are you?
We've encountered them.
Those are Klingons?
Back in the disco, Stamets Prime has survived, and he is back to work. Like, he has not taken paid time off at this point. He's walking around with suitcases into the spore room, which I guess isn't totally dead. And he's got a message for the crew, and the message is the mycelial network is dying, and it's the Mirror Universe ship's fault. And this is the first of many instances in the episode, Ben, that the show begins virtue signaling in a way that we've been accused of personally. This opens up another big Pandora's box here, because it allows us to talk about, this is something that Star Trek does. This is something that Star Trek has always done with varying degrees of sincerity and success. How do you think this episode did with the way it talked about its own virtue, W/R/T, Starfleet versus Terran Empire?
Well, it is super on the nose, and it is super unsubtle. It's basically like Terran Empire is Trump, and yeah. Starfleet is like environmental sustainability. Like, they even use the word sustainable. I wonder if like make the Empire glorious again is something that was in an original script or something that they added later. It's hard not to interpret that as what it is.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's a fairly transparent description of, you know, bad guys use up all their resources in a giant, wasteful, gas-guzzling Hummer. And, you know, aliens spilling over the borders and, like, not every decision or choice being equal, like the idea of strong and capable people needing to rise, and, you know, the weak being in a social or economic class below them.
It's interesting because Georgiou is like, that is, she represents that frame of mind, but she's insufficiently evil for Lorca. Like, Lorca
right.
wants to be more hard-nosed and more xenophobic and everything.
Every species, every choice, every opinion is not equal.
Whenever you do any kind of reading about what makes a great script or story, you always get the idea of showing versus telling as a way to convey information or character building or furthering a story. And when you do it this way, when you tell instead of show, there's already been a ton of showing. Like, why do you need to tell, is my point. And to me, if what you're trying to do is convey the ideals of Star Trek as a thing, as a philosophy, and your great hope is maybe even to change some hearts and minds out there and to get them to come on board Team Star Trek philosophically, then I don't think you can do it this way. If you're already on board, you already know. And if you're broadcasting these messages to people who aren't on board, I'm not sure this is the way to do it. Like, this feels kind of alienating in a way that is counter to what may be a secondary goal of a show's philosophy.
I think maybe the crime of it is that it's a little bit weak as writing.
I think this is the first time that the writing of an ep has really stuck out to me as a little bit clangy in the dialogue. Like, a couple of the notes are a little bit off to me. Like, there's a line that Lorca has where he makes the speech to the capital ship, you know, as like, hey, I'm in command now. He's more or less addressing Giorgio and Burnham in so doing. And he sort of says, it's indecorous of me to share pillow talk. Sounds like such a look at me line of dialogue by a screenwriter. Like, that is such a $10 word for a $2 character. And that's not the only instance of stuff like that in this episode specifically. I'm not saying that the episode is broken as a script, but there are some parts that are a little sharp using a musical analog.
There's some parts that are a little awesome, in my opinion. There's one point where Giorgio is like, all right, we got to go like take the fight to these asswipes. And they have this hallway gun battle where they're like using, containment fields and guns that come out of the walls and like flashbang grenades, which I guess are especially painful in the mirror universe.
The shield strength countdown that Stamets does is so fun.
This was like, I feel like the hallway gunfight that I've always wanted to see in Star Trek.
I love how Lorca calls her Pippa as a nickname. Like, that's such a fun nickname for a terrible killer, which Giorgio is.
Yeah, and Pippa Middleton, too. Just going, like, if you're named Pippa, chances are you're a terrible killer.
The weapons they use kill people in sort of like a pop of campfire.
Yeah.
It's like campfire gore. It's really a fun way to watch people die.
Yeah. The clearest look that we get at this is when they open that thing to like the trap door to like push Stamets in, but then Lorca just has him shot instead.
Yeah.
Which is a really funny moment. But also, like, I was like, oh shit, if this episode hasn't yet revealed that it's really Mirror Universe Stamets on the disco, this is fucked.
Right. Speaking of Stamets, he's back on the disco doing work and not really grieving Culber at all.
Yeah, like, this is another example of that. Just getting back to work and not being damaged by the horrible thing that has happened to you. And in Stamets' case, it's like a series of horrible things have happened to him.
This show does such a great job of turning that damage into currency that it felt different from other episodes in that way.
I wonder if that's just because Stamets is kind of a weird guy and kind of emotionally disconnected to begin with. Or if it's necessitated by the events that are occurring around him and that the grief of what's happened to him is going to hit him like a ton of bricks later.
Yeah, I mean, his character development has always been, much like Tilly, a little bit spectrum-y.
Yeah.
And he came right out of the gates as that kind of scientist who did not have a lot of social graces, so it makes sense that he might be processing his grief differently than other people would.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons? Klingons? Those are Klingons?
What the hell is going on this ship?
I have no idea.
What is this?
So we set up these kind of like parallel storylines where Michael Burnham has escaped and is sneaking around the Charon and the Prime Universe crew on the disco are trying to put the ship back together and figure out how they're going to get back. And at some point, Michael Burnham is like crawling around in a hatch and uses a computer that's built into the wall to broadcast to the Discovery. And she talks to Saru and explains to him that the Lorca that they've been working with has been an MU all along, and I was like kind of blown away by how little like emotional impact that had on Saru. Like, he's like, what? And then Stamets is like, yeah, that makes total sense. That's why we came here when we did the last jump.
I love that Saru is mostly embarrassed that his ganglia didn't come out. Like, well, I would have known. I've got these things.
The crew of the Disco has all at once and very uniformly digested the fact that they are not getting their captain back because their captain has been an evil bad guy the entire time. And they're going to go it alone from here on in. And so they have to come up with a plan that involves blowing up the giant star thing in the middle of the Charon's superstructure, which is like just a plot point that you could see coming from a mile away.
You see it coming from a mile away because we did, and we're not that smart, but also because, like, the idea of rebels being inside the super weapon and lowering its defenses so that it can be attacked.
Very Star Warsy.
Yeah, totally.
So they kind of split up, and Michael Burnham is going to go talk to George Joe, and the Disco crew have to figure this out. And they have this all-hands meeting in engineering that is basically like, hey, like, so we figured out that we can blow up the orb in the middle of the Charon, and that will destroy it, but we can't penetrate it without using the rest of our spores as like the tip of the weapon because of the containment field around it. And they kind of all have to digest the ramifications of this being that the Discovery is going to be destroyed in the process of destroying the Imperial ship, which they all seem like pretty cool with. They're not like ignorant of the gravity of it or whatever, but they're like, okay, well, I guess, we'll have to just blow our ship up to destroy these assholes.
I was cool with it too. And not because I want to see these characters that I've grown to like die, but because in doing that, it would tie the thread neatly in that, you know, why isn't spore drive technology a thing in the generations that follow the time frame of the show? The idea, and I think we've talked about this before on this show, the idea that the Discovery fails in its mission and is destroyed seems like a way to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, the sense I'm getting is that the damage to the mycelial network being something that, you know, again, the mycelial network being something that undergirds the existence of life in all universes is going to be the reason. It seems like that's where they're heading.
It's a space girdle.
And then, like, Saru kind of becomes the captain in this moment, right? Like, he's like, you know, this is not going to destroy the ship. I'd be ganglia all the way to the floor right now.
It made me really admire Saru even more because we've seen this on other Star Trek shows. The second in command being field promoted to captain often gets the moment where the pip gets put on or the computer on board the ship recognizes him as captain, you know, in a celebratory manner. Like, you don't ever see Saru level up, which I think is good. I admired that about him. It's like business as usual.
It's cool, and he kind of comes to a Kirk-like approach to this. I mean, he even says that he doesn't accept a no-win scenario, but it is coming from a totally different place and a totally different character. Like, he is naturally not given to that way of thinking. And this has been character development for him. Like, he's arrived at this.
Yeah, it's a good look for him.
Yeah, I saw some people on Twitter. I try to avoid this, but I saw some people on Twitter saying that there's been no character development at all in this season for anyone. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I mean, Saru's like not even in the top three of characters, and they've done a ton of development with him.
Yeah, I mean, Saru was avoiding everything in the first half of the season, and now you've got to be brave to be the captain of a starship, and he is. He is in a way that defeats his upbringing. in a really satisfying way.
I think it's cool.
You have your orders? On your way.
So Michael Burnham like walks into Giorgio's panic room, which seems like maybe a bad design in the chair on. The idea that the sanctuary of the emperor is something that somebody can just saunter into.
Like it's on a shopping mall map. It's in between Lush and Macy's.
Yeah, it's on the other end from the food court.
If you're at the body shop, you've gone too far.
They make like an uneasy alliance, basically, that they can bat back at Lorca, and that's going to be good for both of them in the long run. But the way that they wind up deciding to do this is by using Giorgio as bait, essentially. Like Michael Burnham takes Giorgio up to the throne room and like, you know, shoves Giorgio to the floor.
Interrupting Lorca just reading Ayn Rand out loud to the rest of the people in the throne room.
Yeah.
Lorca's like the wealthy college kid who was just obsessed with her books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just can't wait to tell you all about them.
I think there's a lot of people in this country that are obsessed with her books and don't mature past it.
Yeah. The idea of Burnham brokering a deal with Giorgio is an example of the way they both manipulate each other. Burnham manipulating Giorgio because the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But Giorgio manipulating Burnham a little bit because she's her only way out of this, if there is one.
Giorgio knows that the goal here is to blow up the ship, right? So, I mean, she's playing a very long odds game at this point. And I think that she's already sort of made her peace with the idea that she's been deposed.
Right.
Like, it's not a hard decision for her at the end to say, you know, I'm gonna kill as many of these guys as I can while you beam out of here.
Burnham proposes to Lorca, hey, I got this Giorgio you wanted, and you can have me too, but just my mind, all right?
Yeah, no boning down for us.
She sort of like gestures to her body, like this stays inside the breastplate. Yeah. Lorca kind of accepts this idea, like whatever gets him close to Burnham is good enough. And it's at this point that the Disco comes out of warp and shoots at the palace ship, and that gives them cover to get into a great big Star Trek fight.
Yeah, this was some badass shit. Like the Disco like puts a shot right through the dome in the throne room, which pretty risky maneuver considering that Burnham is in there. But
yeah,
great big Star Trek fight. A ton, like a huge fight too. There's like 8 or 9 different people squaring off in this fight, and you know, lots of different weapons, lots of like, you know, like you can see the evilness of the Mirror Universe people in their fighting style. Like at one point Landry yeah. just shoots one of her own guys to get through him to try and shoot Burnham,
and Lorca slices at Landry to get her off of Burnham later.
Yeah.
There's a really fun scene where Giorgio is grabbed from behind and then does one of those high kicks to kick Lorca in the face.
Yeah.
Like, facing the other way. That was so great. Like, I want to see the behind the scenes of that moment. Like, yeah. Was it another person?
The fake leg that they swing up?
Yeah.
I think that was really her. Wasn't she in Crouching Tiger? Doesn't she have, like, really serious martial arts training?
She really does.
Michael Burnham and Captain Giorgio, like, doing a huge fight scene together has been really satisfying every time we've gotten it. Like, they are great together. They took down an entire ship full of Klingons, and they're doing pretty good here with these Mirror Universe bad guys.
Yeah, Michelle Yeoh's 55, and she is kicking all kinds of ass here.
She makes it look easy.
She's 5'4", which is another interesting fact, because Jason Isaacs does not exactly tower over her.
No, I think he's a handsome short in the best Hollywood tradition.
5'11" is Jason Isaacs. So
he's not that short.
Not at all. Yeah, I mean, that's there may be a little bit of forced perspective at play here.
Yeah, they put her up on an apple box when she did that kick.
Yeah, maybe a half apple.
Maybe like a half apple and a pancake.
Yeah, squint and a finger gun out to all you production peeps out there.
Yeah. this winds up being like a knife and sword fight toward the end, which is
right.
Just pretty intense. And Giorgio like gets knocked out in her World Series trophy, and Michael Burnham like finishes off the last person she was fighting and is like runs up to Lorca and again goes for the Vulcan neck pinch a couple of times and gets grabbed like just in time.
Right.
Which I love that is like an established, like everybody knows you got to keep the neck away from Michael Burnham if you're doing a fist fight.
I wonder if that's why Mirror Universe peeps wear the brass collar turtleneck.
Oh, neck pinch armor?
Yeah, seems that way. Got some neck mail there.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder, though, because it's like they wear it all the time. How often are they actually fist fighting with Vulcans? You know,
that really looks like it would chafe too around the neck. You really got to powder that neck before you go out. We get our, I think, our fourth and final monologue here, and it's Burnham monologizing to Lorca about who Starfleet is and who Starfleet is not, and it's a way for her to say that we would have helped you had you only asked, and I'm also not going to kill you because I'm true blue Starfleet. And then from behind, the Voltron sword goes through Lorca's chest.
Fun special effect.
Yeah. Always a good time when you get a through and through by a sword.
Yeah. And our buddy Lorca gets kicked down the stairs and into the orb. There's like a total TIE fighter noise as he's dissolving, which is really weird.
In the same way that I think my Stamets theory was wishful thinking. I wonder if this is the last Jason Isaacs scene, or maybe by going through the trapdoor, he becomes part of the network in a way that we can't predict right now. I have a feeling they use the trapdoor for killing a lot of people. So if that were the case, there's probably hundreds of people locked in the network that we'd know of by now.
I mean, I think that there's a real implication in, like in his exposition monologue to Stamets earlier on, that they use the phrase the transporter signal swapped, which really implies that Prime Universe Lorca is in the Mirror Universe somewhere.
Yeah, and I hope so, because as I've said a few times before, Jason Isaacs is a treasure on this show especially, and I would hate for this to be the last time that he's in the show.
It's interesting, the experience I have with Mirror Universe, I don't, like, and it's been a long time since I've seen an episode in another one of the series about Mirror Universe, but I don't remember characters being so sentimental about their counterparts, you know? Like Michael Burnham really loves Giorgio, despite the fact that it's not her Giorgio, and vice versa. You know, I might be wrong about this, but it seems something like that's kind of new to Star Trek's use of this dumb plot device.
That's a moment that's illustrated in a scene we didn't talk about, which was Lorca getting Disco on the screen and telling that other bridge crew how much respect he had for them, and how, you know, if he thought there was a chance that they were strong enough to survive in his universe, he'd have them all over for a party. But because they are feckless, cowardless Federation people, no can do.
Yeah.
So earlier on, they come up with the plan, the Disco plan, to blow up the ship and get back into Prime Universe, and it involves shooting torpedoes at the energy sphere, going through the sphere, beaming Burnham back to the ship, and then coasting on the wave to get back to where they belong.
Tilly and Stamets like come up with the solution to the no-win scenario, which is that they can use warp and spore at the same time to protect themselves from the shockwave like when the core goes, it's going to be just a total mess of mycelium all over the place. And
you are not going to want to use a black light in this area of the quadrant for a long, long time.
They were worried that that was going to tear her apart then. And they work out a way for it not to. And it's really fun. You know, like I feel like the Chiron ship design is like entirely about this sequence where they get to like shoot the rapids and punch through the orb in the middle.
And the moment they get Burnham on their sensors to beam her over is the moment where Georgiou says, "Hey, you got to leave me here. I'm a dead person anyway. They've already seen my whole ass. Like, there's no way I'm gonna ever be emperor again. RSVP me." And so Burnham begins to take this at face value, hides in a corner, and then gets the disco on her communicator for the beam out. But before she does, she runs over and grabs Georgiou in a bear hug mid-beam and takes her to the disco.
Classic impulsive Burnham.
Yeah.
What? What's happening? What's all this?
I'm trying to save you.
What is this?
So they start their black alert, and they start to go through the mycelial network, and Stamets is having a real hard time holding it together because they have found themselves in the Bill and Ted time travel sequence.
Yeah, I mean, up until now, no one at the disco, I think, really knew what it looked like to go through the network, and there it is, like, on screen. They're in it.
It's a lot like the Star Trek IV time travel sequence where it gets a little impressionistic for a while. And yeah. And then he is in either the network or his own imagination talking to Culber. And Culber like calms him down and he follows the music. And they wind up in their own universe. The spores dissipate and a bright green dot lands on Tilly's shoulder and like incorporates itself into her shoulder, which seemed really like it was very specifically setting something up.
Yeah. What do you think that's about?
I don't know. Maybe she'll have a Deanna Troi baby that develops over the entire next episode.
That's how babies happen in Star Trek.
Except for it's not her belly, but her shoulder that gets really big. And everybody's like, "Oh, what's going on?"
Gross.
And they're back, but they, they like radio up Starfleet and nobody picks up the phone. They get the war map on screen. And as the tactical computer updates, it's like showing them the last 9 months in a rapid sequence. It turns out that they overshot their time period by 9 months. And that has been enough for the Klingons, who, despite the absence of Cole and Voke and Laurel, have really kicked the shit out of the Federation.
I thought this was a nice payoff to the delay that Stamets has inside the network. There's a good 10 to 15 seconds where he doesn't know where to go, and they keep moving forward. And I thought that was nice. Like, there's no way they could land in their space and time accurately with that kind of delay. The thing about that transport, though, is that, like, the continuity of color was confusing to me, and that the red was associated with the decay of the network, and blue is emblematic of, like, a healthful mycelial network. And so when it turned red, I thought something awful was happening, something right. More awful than just a confusion of the spore helmsman.
Yeah, I wondered about that red. It seems to have not really been motivated by anything, right? Or if it was, that has not been revealed. But it was so subtle that it doesn't seem like it would be anything at this point.
Yeah. So the Klingons won the war. RSVP Lorca.
RSVP the Federation.
RSVP the Federation. Mirror Universe Georgiou on Prime Universe Disco in Prime Universe.
With rifle.
Yeah.
They can disable the rifle mid-transport, right?
That's a 24th century technology. if only she had a Garrett on her, she may still be armed.
Yeah.
Very brisk storytelling. in episode 13.
But a full-length episode. It wasn't 10 minutes shorter than the others like last episode.
Right.
Did you like this episode, Adam?
Yeah, I really did. There was, as I said before, like some of the dialogue was clangy to me, but the story itself I thought was very satisfying and interesting, and visually it was as stunning as the show gets. Especially the sequence of the disco making the big Emelman into the ship, shooting the energy sphere, going through the sphere, going to warp on the wave. Like, that entire sequence was really theatrically breathtaking, like breathtaking on any, by any measure.
Yeah, it was complicated too. Like, they had to set up what that is over the course of the entire episode, and then it's satisfying when they pay it off.
Yeah, that part was really fun. Disappointed and sad that, I mean, Landry's dead again. Lorca's dead again. Like, great big body count this episode.
Yeah.
Maybe the biggest yet.
Landry has really not had a lot of luck.
Yeah, and too bad, because I think Rekha Sharma is pretty great.
Yeah.
So maybe that's her going into Tilly's shoulder.
Mycelial Landry.
Yeah, what did you think, Ben?
I do really think that the writing in this episode fell apart a little bit, and it does feel like it could have been subtler and better about the points that it's trying to make.
Right.
The fact that Lorca is wearing that red hat that says "Make the Empire Glorious Again" is just like, come on, guys.
Yeah, one thing we didn't really touch on was his "Fate is Real" monologue, which is like the idea that the rich and powerful are somehow deserving of their wealth and power.
Right.
Like, fairly contemporary themes.
Yeah,
here.
The divine right of kings is real, y'all.
Yeah.
While that stuff was unsubtle, it's points I like to see made in my fiction and in my nonfiction. I missed Ash Tyler in this episode. I thought it was pretty wild that he is not even mentioned, much less in it.
Yeah, I mean, a character that they've spent entire episodes developing and depicting, the degrees of Ash Tyler, not really a factor this episode.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they are getting back to Prime Universe an episode earlier than I would have expected. And to me, that is all about Ash Tyler in a way. Like,
right.
There's got to be so much work to be done in resolving that, because it feels like the most untied up thread. But maybe they're setting that up for like the season two arc. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. A season two that they're in production on right now, from what I read.
Wow. It's definitely not my favorite. I have the most mixed feelings about this episode, maybe of any so far.
It's interesting how writing sometimes, when it's at its best, is not noticeable in the way that great editing is. And I think part of the problem in this episode is that you notice the writing so much, and that can really cut both ways. In this way, I think we may be in agreement that in noticing it, we notice it to its detriment.
Yeah. Well, do you want to check and see if we have any P1s, Adam?
Yeah.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Ben, today's priority one message is from It Puts the Moose Lube TM on its skin. Trademarking Moose Lube there. And it is for Or It Gets the Bint Wrong Again.
Wow, people are starting to put message in the to and from.
Which is great, because the form asks, names only, please. Blatant disregarding of the rules here.
I feel like the form asking for names only, please, feels like something that's our fault.
Yeah, I think we've encouraged this.
I feel like Maximum Fun wouldn't have had to do that if it hadn't been for us.
Right. Message goes like this. P4, Moose Lube TM, for when your nuck is stuck and your duck won't suck. Any Canuck schmuck worth a buck will tell you. If your luck is rung amuck, tuck your stuck nuck into Moose Lube TM. Perfect for duck, duck, gray duck. Perfect for duck, duck, gray nuck.
Okay.
So I read that and stuck the landing, almost. I feel like this should have been a commercial Priority One message, Ben. It clearly sells a product, and that product is Moose Lube TM.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've not used much lube in my life, but if I had a moose, I would definitely buy this.
Well, our show is almost entirely supported by listeners, and Priority One messages are a great way to do that. So if you're interested in supporting the ongoing production of The Greatest Discovery, you can go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. Get on the calendar for some Season 2 action. I don't know, Ben, we haven't talked about doing a Season 2, but I think I'd like to keep doing this show. What do you think?
I like this show a lot. I have fun doing it, and it feels fun in a different way from Greatest Gen. So,
yeah,
I think I'm in.
Ensure the future of The Greatest Discovery by your support. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, only 2 episodes left in the in Season 1, so get on it.
We do an embarrassing Star Trek podcast, and a big part of our success is owning that, being ourselves in all our embarrassing glory. But what if we didn't? What if we were just a Star Trek podcast? No embarrassment, no comedy, just Star Trek podcast. If you're somebody who wants a website, you could go generic and bland and one size fits all on a social media platform, or you could buy a custom URL and design a custom website with Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform for all kinds of people to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. So whoever you are, or whatever you're trying to do, own it with Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/trek to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to, oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible.
I did. My drunk Shimoda is a timestamp Shimoda. It's really just all through this fight scene in the throne room toward the end. They do a great job. I mean, they're covering this scene from all different angles, and they got the camera running at all different speeds, but kind of to stage left of the throne. And through a lot of this fight, maybe like most noticeably around like the 32-minute mark, there's a guy in a gray jumpsuit that is like on all fours and, you know, like shaking off a blow to the head or something.
Uh-huh.
And I guess just like in the choreography of the fight, they made a lot of decisions about this guy and deciding why he's not involved in the action, because I guess they needed a couple more people chambered for toward the end. But this guy is on all fours for like a solid minute of this fight, just like, whoa, whoa. And I love that. Like, I feel like if I was in a big free for all fight like that, and I knew I was a red shirt, in the way that this guy clearly knows he's a red shirt, I would be, I would really milk those moments of still being alive.
I love a background Shimoda, Ben.
Yeah. How about yourself? Who's your drunk Shimoda?
My Shimoda is going to be a technique, a production technique, which is something that I call around the horn.
Mm-hmm.
And that is reaction shot salad, which is something that we get several times in this episode in a way that I feel like we get two more action shots than your doctor would typically prescribe. There's the reveal that Lorca is a Terran. And then we see every single person on the bridge look at every single other person on the bridge.
Yeah, it feels like this show is starting to get a little self-conscious about the fact that we don't really know the bridge crew.
Yeah, they do it there, and they also do it when it is revealed that they are 9 months late to the party. And when you're 9 months late to a party, and if you don't show up, does it really matter? They also get almost shot for shot another around the horn of the bridge crew. I think it's for the reason that you described. More FaceTime for everyone, especially on a show that a relative few get dialogue, is, I think, the game here. Though in this episode, we do give a lot of dialogue to the robot person.
Yeah.
More than ever before, who maybe we'll get to know even better in these last two episodes. But I'm just going to give the Shimoda to another bit of a clanger this episode. Like, things that are sticking out to me in a way that don't... Like, this is the nail head that sticks up from the board, this sequence, and it does a couple of times.
Right.
What do we have coming up on the next dip? Our second from the last.
The next episode is season one, episode 14, The War Without, The War Within. We saw a little action with Sarek and Admiral Bob beaming onto the bridge with guns. And it seems like they are going to turn to evil Georgiou for war advice because the war is going bad, but not as bad as they sort of made it seem in the actual episode today. it goes from the war is lost to the Klingons have occupied 20% of Federation space in the span of like the end of the actual episode and the preview for the next episode.
Yeah, I noticed that as well.
So that was a little bit of a relief.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to how Mirror Georgiou integrates herself into this crew. I mean, this isn't the first time that an enemy captive has been brought on board, Laurel being the other, and we get to see some cutscenes of Laurel in this preview as well. So, interesting times ahead, I think. Who we don't see is any Ash Tyler in the preview.
The title of the final episode has been revealed to be Will You Take My Hand, which just doesn't sound like anything but an Ash Tyler episode.
Will you take my power gloved hand in marriage?
Yeah.
Well, looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Can't believe two more episodes left. It's been a fun run so far.
I wonder if that last one will be like a double long or if this will be a two episode arc that we're sailing into.
Yeah. I hope we get a movie length finale to the season. I think that'd be a lot of fun. I think the one thing I've been wanting the entire season is longer episodes, so hopefully we get that.
Yeah. Well, looking forward to it. Had a lot of fun talking with you about it today, Adam, and with that, we'll leave it to Rob from here on in.
The Greatest Discovery is a MaximumFun.org podcast, hosted by Adam Pranica and Benjamin R. Harrison, and produced and edited by Rob Schulte. Music by Adam Ragusea. Head to MaximumFun.org to support the ongoing production of this show. Please use the hashtag GreatestGen when discussing the show on Twitter. You can find Ben on Twitter at BenjaminAHR, and Adam is at CutForTime. And make sure to check out the Greatest Gen Reddit and Facebook groups if you're looking to continue the conversation even further.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.